KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At the height of the debate over same-sex marriage in this country, opponents were suggesting these strained scenarios as consequences of making these marriages legal. Marriage would lose its meaning, they would say. People could marry their pets or their children or their cars. And what about polygamy? That often came up. The argument went, if you legalize same-sex marriage, can you really keep a man from marrying more than one wife? Well, it's a good question. And today in the program, we're talking about it. What does the Supreme Court ruling mean for polygamy in this state? And no state has a stronger interest or investment in the question than Utah. But beyond that, is it about time to just decriminalize it? Is this a question of religious liberty or just equal protection? Join us after the news. This week on Video West, go see filmmaker Nate Gunn's piece on Ogden photographer and mountaineer Andy Earle. Tragedy can change things, make you want to back off, stay home. But Andy had to fill his heart with something, and he found it in the Utah mountains. Go to videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Just ask an advocate for same-sex marriage how long it took to get a ruling from the Supreme Court. Decades, of course. And it was more than just a legal process. It was cultural, too. A lot of it had to do with what the country would bear and whether the U.S. was ready. Well, compare that to the question of whether polygamy should be legal. Is the country ready for that? Most people are going to say, probably not, but it does seem like there's a process underway, and it may be tied in some ways to the same-sex marriage process. That is to say, legal fits and starts, victories and losses, one ruling going one way, another ruling going another. In fact, that's what's happened in Utah. A few years ago, a federal judge struck down a part of Utah's law on polygamy. It was in the case of Cody Brown and his four wives. They were reality TV stars for a time, and they argued that Utah's law violated their religious liberty. That was seen as a victory, that ruling. But then this month, a federal appeals court vacated that ruling. That's a loss. Today in the program, we're talking about where this process seems to be headed and how the legal history of polygamy may be influencing it. Joining us on the program is Frederick Geddix, who is holds the Guy Anderson Chair at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at Brigham Young University. His work focuses on law and religion and on constitutional law as well. He has a number of books, among them the forthcoming Freedom of Religion and Secular Government. We should also mention that he's represented FLDS polygamists in the past, and Professor Geddix is joining us from the studios of KBYU in Provo. And Professor, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Casey Faucon is also with us, a fellow at the Community Economic Development Clinic at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. She's written about polygamy for the Duke Journal of Gender, Law, and Policy and for the Harvard Law and Policy Review. She has an article called Decriminalizing Polygamy in the forthcoming Utah Law Review, and Casey Faucon is joining us from a studio in Denver. And welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
All right, I want to start. We need to set the table with a couple of things so people understand sort of some of the background here. So a federal appeals court, as I mentioned, ruled that Cody Brown cannot sue the state. And Professor Geddix just explained this. The court didn't actually rule on the merits of whether criminalizing polygamy violates religious freedom or rights of privacy. It just said they didn't have a standing to sue, basically, right?
Yes. More than standing, it was a ruling that the case didn't exist,
right,
so to speak.
They shouldn't have brought it in the first place, right?
That's right. Yeah, the Constitution requires that federal courts only rule on actual cases and controversies. And because the Lehigh prosecutor who had originally opened the investigation of the Browns swore under oath that they were not subject to prosecution under the bigamy law, the Tenth Circuit decided that there was no case, there was no controversy, there was no credible threat of prosecution, and so they vacated the holding.
So does that, Keisuke Fukan, does that sort of leave us back at square one now, sort of where we're sort of starting from scratch again?
No. So we can learn a lot from the Brown versus Boumin case. We're certainly not starting over, and it's certainly not the first time that a polygamist has challenged the Utah anti-polygamy law.
Yeah.
So we're not really starting over from square one. There's certainly a lot of lessons to be learned, right? As Professor Geddick said, the Tenth Circuit held that there was no case or controversy. So we really need to learn from how we would approach this in the courts next time.
Yeah.
Certainly having an actual case or controversy, having a plaintiff or having a defendant, I should say, who is actually prosecuted under the anti-polygamy statute would kind of bring this case through that procedural hurdle that the Tenth Circuit decided to hone in on instead of giving us a decision on the merits.
Right. Which, and we'll get to this a little bit later, that's going to be tough if, in fact, the state isn't actually prosecuting these cases. And that leads us to Professor Geddick's, we should talk about where Utah's law is. Let's remind people of where we are in Utah anyway. There is a law in the books, one with this deep, complex history. It makes plural marriage illegal. It's embedded in the state constitution, which we'll get back to because that's pretty interesting. But Utah basically, if I understand it right, has chosen to look the other way for the most part for various reasons. But they like the law in place because there's sexual assault and there's child abuse. And so you at least and sometimes there's like welfare fraud, too. So they want this in place. But they is it fair to say for the most part, they're sort of looking the other way, though?
I don't know if I would describe it as looking the other way. As I think it's more a strategic decision they've made to prevent a case like the Browns from actually being adjudicated. They only bring bigamy charges in connection, as you said, with sexual assault and child abuse and other sorts of cases. And that ensures that any case in which the anti-bigamy statute is challenged as applied to polygamy will be in the midst of a sordid set of facts. It will be bad facts, so to speak, as lawyers say, rather than a relatively wholesome polygamous family like the Browns.
Okay. I want to talk about this this ruling that was vacated by the Tenth Circuit. This was a couple of years ago. This was 2013. U.S. Judge Clark Wadups struck down one part of the Utah bigamy law. Now, what I want to get a sense of, and maybe Keisuke Fukan, you can tell us, what was the significance of that ruling? It's been vacated now, but what was the significance of it? Did the judge actually rule on the merits, on the question of whether or not polygamy was a protected religious liberty?
He did, and that is why the case has some significance. So what Judge Wadups actually did is he looked at the language of the Utah anti-bigamy statute, which basically says a person is guilty of bigamy if knowing they are married or the person that they are married to is married to somebody else, they purport to marry that person or they cohabit with another person. And what Judge Wadups did was he took that cohabitation prong and said that this applies to the Browns. This applies to their behavior, right? Mm-hmm. He said that they are not purposely trying to have the state legally recognize their marriage. They haven't applied for multiple marriage licenses. But what they are doing is engaging in this sort of religious cohabitation, where they engage in a religious ceremony and they begin to live together as a polygamous family, right? They cohabit together. And essentially what Judge Wadups did is looked is at how that application applies to the Browns and their constitutional freedoms, mm-hmm. Their free exercise of religion, their substantive due process rights to be free in the privacy of their home, to engage in the sort of alternative sexual and lifestyle relationships that they have. So he essentially held that that cohabitation prong, that second part of the statute, was unconstitutional as applied to the Browns. So then what he did was leave in place in the statute only marriage fraud. Right. So if you would try to apply to the state for multiple marriage licenses, or if, for example, Cody didn't tell his other wives that he was already married, involving some sort of marriage fraud. So Judge Wadoops essentially decriminalized informal polygamy in Utah with his ruling.
One of the things he said, the judge, was that Utah had essentially incorrectly equated, as Casey Foucan, you mentioned, the incorrectly equated private sexual relations between unmarried persons with marriage. And Professor Geddix, this is one thing you've talked about, that one of the real problems with the Utah law is that it's only applied to religious people, people who are secular and cohabitating. They're not punished. The state doesn't go after them.
Yes, that's right. It's very common in the state of Utah and elsewhere in the United States for a couple to cohabit while one of them, sometimes both of them, are awaiting a final decree of divorce from someone else. And in the state of Utah, that is bigamous cohabitation, cohabiting with someone while legally married to someone else. And of course, those cases are never brought. There's not a single reported case in the history of the state of Utah in which individuals in that circumstance were prosecuted under the bigamy law. The bigamy law has only ever been deployed against religious polygamists.
Okay, there's one more case I want to sort of get under our belts before we dig more into this. This was a case you were actually involved in, you consulted with. This is a police officer from Hilldale. This is the polygamous community of Hilldale and Colorado City on the border. A man by the name of Rodney Holm. He was a police officer, as I said, and he was convicted. This was back in 2003 of this polygamous relationship. And he pushed the issue up to the state Supreme Court, which upheld the conviction. But the court was clearly influenced, Frederick Geddix, by the fact that Holm had this 16-year-old spiritual wife. That is behavior that is criminalized, or at least seen with some sense of suspicion, but they didn't rule on the merits of religion, religious freedom or privacy in that case either. Now, here's the thing I want to ask you about, because what's really interesting about this case is that the Chief Justice at the time, Christine Durham, wrote this really long dissent, this 37-page dissent, in which she noted that the law, as you said, doesn't prosecute people who cohabitate and aren't in a legal marriage. Now, let's talk about this, because it seems like the Chief Justice at the time, Christine Durham, was making the same kind of case that you are.
Yes. My co-counsel in that case, Rod Parker, we like to believe that she was persuaded by our briefing, even if no one else was.
Okay.
But that's precisely the argument. And the argument holds even with respect to this curious strategic decision by the Attorney General's office to only bring polygamy cases as add-ons to other sorts of prosecutions. You could imagine a man living with a woman while awaiting his divorce from someone else. And let's suppose that that he's charged with abuse of that woman with whom he's cohabiting, or with children who are present in the home. I'm fully confident that the state of Utah would not add on a charge of bigamous cohabitation to a charge of domestic abuse or child abuse. Even the add-on is only added on for religious polygamists. And so it really is quite a clear case of religious discrimination, where a group of religious individuals are singled out by the state to bear a burden and a punishment that's not applied against anyone else.
Because there are, as you say, there are laws on the books to deal with child rape, welfare fraud, domestic abuse. As you say, you don't need to contain that within a statute related to polygamy or bigamy to get at those crimes.
Yes, that's right. And that's reflective of a more general constitutional proposition, the secondary effects doctrine. We don't generally prohibit the exercise of constitutional rights or fundamental rights because of the secondary effects we cause. We simply regulate the secondary effects directly. So if someone's speaking in a park, engaging in controversial speech and causes violence against the speaker or other people, the answer is not to punish the speaker or to silence the speaker. The answer is to have an increased security presence, better policing, and to punish the people who engage in the violence. And so the same thing holds with polygamy. The fact that there might be criminal behavior associated with polygamy, I'm not entirely convinced that that is true, that that's any greater as a general matter with respect to polygamy than with respect to monogamy. But the answer, again, is to punish the criminal behavior, not to criminalize the religious exercise of that community.
Casey Fakan, wanted to get you on that point. We'll come back to this issue that you've been writing about, and that is it probably makes sense to remove the idea of not make the case for religious liberty and just make the case for equal protection or due process. We'll come back to that. But let me just hear you on this question of what we were just talking about here with Professor Geddes.
Right. So Professor Geddes is correct. We already have laws on the books that deal with the ancillary effects of having or practicing polygamy within these secluded, enclosed, cut-off societies, right? We already have laws that outlaw and criminalize spousal abuse, child marriages, welfare fraud, etc. And I think part of needing the polygamy laws to, quote-unquote, reach these other ancillary crimes, you have a problem of causation. So I've written a little bit on how we personify just abuse in marriage in general. And Professor Geddes talked about it briefly earlier. But statistically, there's no more evidence that polygamous families or polygamous marriages are more abusive or cause more harm than monogamous marriages. Yeah. We know that monogamy has not been free from abuse towards women. In fact, for a long time, historically, marriage has been very suppressive of women and has allowed abuses to occur within the protection of the marriage laws. So I think it's a partly of how we personify abuse in these relationships. As Professor Geddes said, sometimes when we hear about these polygamous kind of abuses, they're viewed as a generalization about these polygamous communities and not just rogue characterizations of these of bad actors, of renegade criminals. So you might hear stories of people abusing their wives or engaging in child marriage, but we talk about that person in the individual, that guy is so bad.
Yeah.
But when we talk about this or we hear stories about this in the polygamous context, we use it as a generalization, right? All of those polygamists abuse their wives and children, and we kind of sensationalize the bad acts of one person and apply it to all of polygamists. And that, I think that conflates the issue with whether or not polygamy itself causes all of these ancillary crimes that we are worried about stamping out.
And this gets us to a bigger question, which we'll probably come back to. This is about context. This is about these societies in which these kinds of things are taking place. Frederick Geddes, is it fair to say that? I mean, these are pretty isolated, insular communities in many ways. That's got to be contributing to these crimes, as opposed to just saying it's de facto polygamy.
Well, I think that's true of the FLDS community, which has always been exceptionally private and has taken steps to isolate itself from the rest of society, perhaps somewhat less so in the last generation than when it was founded. I'm not sure it's it's so true of other kinds of polygamy. There are actually other offshoots of the LDS Church, other FLDS-like communities, which are not nearly as isolated. Their members have access to the news and circulate freely outside of the society. And, of course, that's not even to mention the people that Professor Foucan has written about, African-American and African-Muslim polygamists who are actually becoming as common as fundamentalist Mormon polygamists.
This is an important point that Casey Foucan writes about, actually, and I wanted to talk to you about that. You point out fundamentalist Mormons aren't the only players here. And it seems like, and maybe this is just a Utah thing, you know, whenever you're talking about polygamy in Utah for obvious reasons, it's within that Mormon context. But this is a bigger story than just the Mormon experience.
Yes, that's true. I think we like to, or we often associate the polygamy discussion with the Mormons, especially in Utah, and with the history that we have with polygamy in the Mormon church. But they're not the only players in this polygamy debate. You're right. There are a number of African-American Muslims who live on the East Coast, for example, who practice polygamy also as part of their faith, but also for cultural and identitarian reasons as well. You'll run into this issue again with the increase in immigration from countries that allow polygamy. You have to remember that the United States doesn't live in a vacuum. We're not the first country to deal with, nor will we be the last country to deal with the issue of polygamy. And many countries around the world do allow it under certain limitations and restraints. So you do have to keep in mind that it's not just polygamy within the kind of Southwest communities yeah. that are offshoots of the Mormon Church. There's also a larger group of people who practice it for other religious reasons and people who practice it for secular reasons, right? Our polyamorous or poly yeah. groups of people who practice it for secular reasons that have nothing to do with religion at all.
So what's different about the attitude in the United States? I mean, you say in your Law Review article that In the American society and the law, we've sensationalized polygamy as being abusive and as subversive. Is that different from how other countries think about polygamy?
I think it is different to some extent about how other countries deal with polygamy. Like I said earlier, our history with polygamy focuses heavily on how we've dealt with it in relation to the Mormon Church in general.
Yeah.
And I think that sensationalism stems all the way back to political discussions and cartoons from the late 1800s,
yeah.
which characterized Mormon polygamists as being like an other race. They have political cartoons that put them on the same playing field as Chinese Americans, as Native Americans, as Irish Americans, as being problematic, quote unquote, others.
Yeah.
So that kind of sensationalism or the way that we treat polygamists stems from that long history with how we've politicized polygamist behavior in general.
I want to come back to the question of history when we get back from a break. Casey Foucan is with us at the Sturm College of Law at the University of Denver. Frederick Geddix is professor of law at Brigham Young University, joining us from the studio of KBYU in Provo. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking whether the recognition of same-sex marriage has opened any doors for polygamy and what the legal future of plural marriage might be. Casey Foucan is with us of the Sturm College of Law at the University of Denver, and we have Frederick Geddix of the he's a professor of law at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at Brigham Young University. He holds the Guy Anderson Chair there. He's joining us from Provo. Casey Foucan is joining us from Denver. I wanted to ask about, so Professor Geddix, let's talk a little bit about this, the history of this original case. This is Reynolds versus the United States in the late 1800s. Talk about the case And the sort of the legacy of this on this question of marriage and polygamy in the United States.
Well, polygamy was one of the twin relics of barbarism condemned by the Republican Party when it was formed in the late 1850s. The other, of course, was slavery. Mm-hmm. And in the aftermath of the Civil War, a variety of events conspired to prevent any serious prosecution of Mormon polygamists until after the death of Brigham Young. And the Reynolds case, George Reynolds was the defendant, a Mormon, obviously, Mormon polygamist. The church actually, and Reynolds, brought it as a test case, thinking that marriage had always been viewed as a domestic matter for the states, and therefore thinking that as a territory, they would be accorded the same sort of deference that states received with respect to their marriage laws. Mm-hmm. The religious freedom aspect was really not the central part of Reynolds' defense to the charge of bigamy, although that actually has been the element of the case that has endured. Reynolds is a case that appears in most religious freedom case books and the case that most people know about. With respect to 19th century Mormon polygamy. As Professor Faucon mentioned before, the opinion in Reynolds is filled with lots of references to the what we might call the un-American character of polygamy, associating it with Africa, with Asia, with minority races or races that are a minority in the United States in an attempt to simply show that this was behavior that was beyond the pale. Most of that language would not be operative today, but the holding still is still part of constitutional law.
Casey Faucon, let me ask you, what do you see as the sort of the lasting legacy of that Reynolds decision in terms of how we're thinking about that issue still today? Has the Utah situation pretty much shaped this issue? Is that still relevant in that sense?
Yeah, I would say that the Utah situation has sort of helped shape the continued legacy or the continued validity of Reynolds. So even though Reynolds is a very old case, it's from the 1870s, courts still rely on it, as Professor Geddick said. They rely on it in interpreting First Amendment challenges. And they rely on it for the question itself of whether or not polygamy bans are constitutional or not. So in some of the later Utah cases, for example, from the 2000s or from the 1980s, for example, they cite to Reynolds and just say Reynolds still controls the question of free exercise of religion and polygamy. We see no reason to overturn it. And they might say something like monogamy is the bedrock of society. That's an important enough social reason to uphold Reynolds. And we're going to continue to apply Reynolds to the polygamy question. So unless there's a case out there or a court that's willing to overturn that essential first ruling on polygamy, we're always going to have to deal with the legacy of Reynolds on the issue of polygamy in the U.S.
Why do you say that this attachment to religion, seeing this as a religious freedom issue, kind of clouds the picture? Because you want people to switch from seeing it as a religious issue as to something that's more about due process, more about equal protection. Why do you see it that way?
Yeah, so when I started researching polygamy, I was heavily entrenched or really interested in the religious motivations and the religious aspects for why people might engage in this type of behavior. And like we previously mentioned, there are numerous different religious tenets and secular reasons why people engage in this particular behavior. So I see it as more of a, or I hope that people see it as more of a substantive due process equality issue. I see it as more of a identity that people kind of take on or they adhere to, which is more in line with our kind of gay rights cases and our cases that are based more on our privacy interests and our rights that are based on our self-identity. I think the religion aspect of it, even though it has such a storied history and is heavily intertwined with polygamy, certainly needs to come into consideration when we're talking about actual regulation of polygamous families, right? Most people who in the U.S. do practice polygamy do so for religious reasons. So I think if we were going to mobilize and have some sort of legal recognition or legal regulation of polygamy, we have to take that religious aspect into account. It's just like if you go into revitalizing a neighborhood, right? You can't bring in outsiders to do that. You have to actually ask people from the community that live there, how do you want your neighborhood to work in order for the revitalization to work? So that same concept kind of applies. You can't ignore the fact that people are religious and they practice this for religious reasons. If you just go in as an expert without understanding the motivations for why they do it, I don't think any type of intervention or legal mobilization will be successful. But when it comes in terms of identifying the reasons why we might decriminalize polygamy or why we might legally recognize it, I think that the religious aspect or the religion argument does sort of muddy the water. I like to make the analogy to the gay marriage rights movement in terms of informing how polyamorous or polygamous might mobilize legally in the future. And I think the religion question can actually turn the conversation into one where there has potential to exclude people who practice polygamy for non-religious reasons. You might have a situation where you practice for secular reasons because you believe that you are a polyamorist and that you are oriented this way that have nothing to do with religion. Right. Yet if we decriminalize polygamy based on religion or legalize it only for those people who profess religious belief in it, we'll be excluding that secular arena of people who practice it for our more kind of liberalist secular reasons.
So you've also said that just focusing on the religious part keeps this from being, you know, the polygamists, it keeps them from being part of this larger sort of shift that's going on culturally about the changing family structure. It leaves them out of that argument, I guess, is what you're saying.
Right. So religious arguments have been used, at least in the gay marriage mobilization, as opposition to the expansion of marriage equality and the expansion of recognizing sexual minorities. So I think that attaching it to religion brings in all of the kind of ingrained political history and problems that we have with polygamy in the United States, and it actually prevents them from becoming part of this larger conversation that secular polyamorists like to engage in. They like to or have found the need to separate themselves, much as the gay community has found the need to because of the response in society and the response from other judicial opinions, to separate themselves from the religious polygamists, right? They say our agendas are different. The way that we practice polyamory or the way that we practice our homosexuality differs from how those religious polygamists do it. And I think that's partly to do with the fact of how we've personified religious polygamists so negatively.
Professor Geddix, what do you think about that? I don't mean to put you at odds with Casey Faucon, but what do you think that shifting away from the religious argument more to one of equal protection, what do you think about that?
Well, I generally agree, frankly. Focusing on the religious aspect of polygamy entangles one in the religious exemption debate, which is complicated enough. But there no longer is, since the Employment Division versus Smith case, the peyote case, there no longer is a constitutional right to be excused from obeying a law that burdens one's religion. There are some statutory protections like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, but no constitutional protection. And so if you're a religious polygamist and you want constitutional protection for your activity, the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution is really not a very effective doctrinal argument to make. the effective argument is one that I've mentioned and that Professor Foucan has mentioned as well, and that is the singling out of religious polygamists for special burdens. And that feeds into the equality argument that Professor Foucan has made and the more general liberty argument, protection under the Due Process Clause, which protects life, liberty, and property against federal and state action. And so I think it's probably more effective to think about the right to practice polygamy as a liberty that one holds without necessarily associating it with religious liberty.
Okay, now acknowledging that we could do a couple of hours on the critiques and the the arguments for and against plural marriage. We should mention a few of these things because this is something, Casey Foucan, that you've been writing about. One of the arguments that you've made is that criminalizing these marriages leaves the other wives without the rights that come to legal spouses. This is one of the arguments that you make. Would you say something about that?
Sure. So NPR actually did a great study on African-American Muslim polygamists living in Philadelphia in 2008. It was a two-part series. And they did interviews with a bunch of different women who are involved in polygamous marriages. Their names were changed, of course. But they talked about how, being second and third wives, they were not able to take advantage of some of the legal rights that are normally afforded to a quote-unquote legal spouse, right? If they divorce or they leave the marriage, they're not entitled to any of the property because as a public policy, we don't recognize polygamous marriages, so we wouldn't recognize that wife's particular rights. At the same time, just the social stigma afforded to second and third and fourth wives who are not able to say in public, this is my spouse or these are my children with my husband who also has other wives and has engages in a polygamous lifestyle. It's the social stigma that attaches as well. So it's not just the sort of legal benefits that second and third wives are unable to have, but it's the social stigma as well. And that social stigma, if we can borrow from the gay marriage cases, at least in the Windsor and Obergefell cases, that social stigma carries a pretty heavy weight in terms of whether or not these polygamy restrictions are constitutional.
Mm. That, of course, the critiques, you know them, critics of legalizing polygamy point to some of the crimes against women and children that happen, especially in closed communities. They say it's beyond just the FLDS communities, for example. They say it's misogynistic. They say it's patriarchal. They say it leads to harms like rape and abuse and birth defects, all kinds of things. How do you respond to those critiques?
Sure. So we've talked a little bit about this already, whether or not polygamy itself is a cause of these ancillary harms, or whether or not it's something else. And I've argued, and other people have argued, that it's not polygamy itself. It's the fact that otherwise despotic and abusive men are allowed to thrive in these enclosed societies outside of the watchful eye of the law because polygamy is criminalized. So the wives and the children feel at odds with turning in their husbands to the police, for example, and they've actually come to distrust police as they've in the past taken children away from parents that they found to later be polygamist.
Okay, I want to, before we get to a break, I want to ask you, which I find to be one of the most compelling bits of information in this whole conversation as we've been preparing this, and this is a really compelling case that you make that is kind of remarkable. You've said that it took some 30 years for social scientists to convince people that being gay is a character trait, that this is something that's immutable, it's an orientation. But you say that on some level, the same can be said for polygamy. Would you mention that? What do you mean? That plural marriage is in some way, or an inclination toward plural marriage, is some kind of orientation?
Right. So that argument sort of stems from what we know and what we've learned about the gay marriage movement and the gay marriage mobilization. So it took a long time for social studies and for society to accept, you're right, that being gay was an orientation. So the way, for example, that people who engaged in homosexual behavior were described in biblical times, for example, it wasn't seen as an orientation. Homosexuality was seen as like an overflow of sexuality. You couldn't contain your sexual urges. It wasn't seen as a biological orientation that you were only attracted to one certain type of sex. Now, there's been some studies done, particularly one called Sex at Dawn, mm-hmm. that studies the psychology of bonobos, actually, and say that they engage in sexual behavior in the same way that humans do. They do it for social reasons, for bonding reasons, for security, but that they're not monogamous, and that we actually mirror our psychology mirrors those of those primates. There's also been some studies out there that just explore what it means to have a sexual orientation in general. Mm-hmm. And if we can kind of explain or explore what sexual orientation means, that we would be able to include that or include polygamous within that orientation. Sexual orientation, we usually think of it as to mean I'm attracted to this particular spouse or this particular sex, excuse me. But sexual orientation is actually much narrower in some respects, right? I'm only attracted to someone of the opposite sex who has blonde hair, for example. But it can also be much broader, right? Bisexuals, I'm attracted to both men and women who have blonde hair, right? So it actually can be much broader, and sexual orientation and what we understand about it is a sliding scale. And if we think about it that way, then we can include polygamous within that understanding of I am made this way. This is immutable. This is my orientation.
Professor Geddix, you want in on this one? The question
of I'm not nearly as familiar with the psychology, but I would offer this. We live in a radically plural society. And even if polygamy, as well as other sexually intimate choices, is a matter of choice, we need to get away from using the law to criminalize behaviors on the basis that we don't like them, we meaning the majority. Yeah. That's a use of the law that puts everyone at risk. Everyone is a minority somewhere. And if we're going to live together and be so different, we need to respect the choices that others make when they don't have negative effects on third parties. And of course, we've already discussed that you prosecute those negative effects. You don't criminalize the behavior that one casually thinks might be associated with it.
That's Frederick Geddix, professor of law at Brigham Young University. Casey Faucon is also with us at the Sturm College of Law at the University of Denver. We'll take another quick break and come back for some final thoughts. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about whether the recognition of gay marriage has opened any doors for polygamy, what the legal future of plural marriage may be. We have with us Frederick Geddix, a professor of law at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at Brigham Young University, the Guy Anderson Chair there. He holds that. And Casey Faucon is a fellow at the Community Economic Development Clinic at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. So the Tenth Circuit Court in their recent ruling, said that the Browns, Cody Brown and his four wives, basically have no case because they haven't actually been prosecuted. So it seems like nothing is going to move forward until there actually is a prosecution. Casey Faucon, you were saying this a little bit earlier. If the state doesn't seem to be interested in doing something like that, are we just sort of stuck until something happens like that?
I don't know if we're necessarily stuck until we have write a case that has an actual case or controversy. And I don't think it's necessarily accurate to say that the legislature hasn't already taken up this issue on its own. So after Judge Wadoop's decision came out in 2013, we had a Utah House representative that actually submitted a bill proposal saying that we should amend the statute in the way that Judge Wadoop interpreted it. So that congressperson used the case in order to mobilize the actual change in the legal statute. Now, that bill didn't actually pass. And now I've learned that there's actually another bill in the Utah House that would actually reaffirm or rewrite the law to prevent challenges like the one that Judge Wadoop's recognized. So it's not necessarily true to say that we would have to wait particularly for another case or controversy for this issue to be brought before before the public eye or before the courts again. There is the possibility that the legislature might act on their own, but again, dealing with the kind of storied political history of polygamy in the U.S., I'm not really sure how far that traction would go in Utah, for example.
Right, that's a good point. Professor Geddix, what about the Utah part of all of this? I mean, Utah's locked in. It's in the state's constitution that polygamy is illegal. I mean, that seems like even a bigger burden than most other states for dealing with this. How much movement would there even be in a state like Utah?
Well, there's some question about whether the constitutional provision was within the power of the federal government to impose. Mm-hmm. There's something called the Equal Footing Doctrine, which holds that states should be admitted to the union on equal footing, on an equality with the states previously admitted.
And no other state had that clause, we should say, right?
Correct. Yeah. But putting that aside, I think one of the interesting things about Utah is the deep social ambivalence about polygamy. Many Mormons, including active Mormons and members of the leadership, are often proud of their polygamous heritage, of the sacrifices that their ancestors endured to be faithful to the principle, as they called it. Mm. And when the church was nearly destroyed over that, there was a strategic decision to bring the Mormon Church into the mainstream on marriage and other issues, into the what one might call the conservative Protestant mainstream. Yeah. And so the church has tried to position itself there, which is why it opposed and continues to oppose gay marriage, and now, in a sense, finds itself running into itself coming around the corner as the result of quickly changing sexual mores and beliefs about marriage.
How long is it going to take? I know that's a ridiculous question. Like, give me a prediction, Casey Faucon, for when polygamy will be legal. That's not what I'm asking. But, I mean, does the Supreme Court, they're not inclined to want to weigh in on something like this. So what's your sense? I mean, cultural mores related to polygamy are different from same-sex relationships. I think that's not an arguable point. So how far off are we on something like this? Can you even speculate?
Yeah, so it's hard to speculate at this point what the prospects of potentially legalizing polygamy would be. Now, we need to talk about just the two different aspects. We've been sort of conflating, and we need to distinguish between the actual decriminalization of the practice mm-hmm. and the actual legalization, recognizing right. more than one spouse. Yeah. And I think that second part, the legalization, recognizing more than one spouse, we're pretty far away from that. You're right. I don't think the Supreme Court would want to answer that question so closely following the heels of the gay marriage cases, which were so controversial and remain, yeah. and which remain very, very controversial. But as to the decriminalization, that's a different question. So, and that one is actually a much closer question and one that might not necessarily require any weigh-in from the Supreme Court in order to do that. So like we have the statute on the books that says that polygamy is illegal, the actual practice of it, you have these policies by the Utah Attorney General and the Utah County Attorney General saying that they'll only prosecute you if you are engaged in in fraud or any one of these other ancillary crimes. Mm. So that kind of raises the questions of what do we do with these statutes that we don't necessarily use or that we only use in order to probe into other crimes that we find to be more heinous. Mm. So I think the decriminalization issue is actually a much closer one, and one that is closer on the horizon than the legalization issue, for sure.
What do you think, Professor Geddix?
I agree with Professor Faucon. I would add also this. One of the differences in decriminalizing polygamy from the same-sex marriage debate is the reticence of many members of the legal academy, many lawyers, about what they perceive as the patriarchy that's inherent in polygamy, the way it's practiced. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a man with multiple wives. It could be a woman with multiple husbands, but that doesn't seem to be the predominant pattern. And I think decriminalization and eventually legalization would become more likely if one were able to establish that these relationships are not inherently patriarchal and abusive, or at least no more so than the other sorts of relationships, such as monogamous marriage, which we already recognize.
It's Professor Frederick Geddix, who teaches at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at Brigham Young University. He's co-author of a forthcoming book called Freedom of Religion and Secular Government. Thanks very much, Professor, for being with us.
Thank you.
And Casey Faucon is a fellow at the Sturm College of Law at the University of Denver. Her article, Decriminalizing Polygamy, is going to be published in the Utah Law Review coming up. Casey Faucon, thanks to you.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.